car had been owned by a doctor, and he'd only driven 24,000 or 25,000 miles, I don't remember which. And it did not have a rumble seat in. He hadn't got that when he purchased it as a sport coupe, but it was a real nice car and serviced me in fine shape. A couple months or such a matter after I'd purchased it, I was in the cafe one evening eating. A fella came into the cafe and says to the woman at the cash register, who owned the cafe, do you know a Homer Givens in this area? And she says, that he is sitting there at the counter. And so he came back and sat down, introduced himself, said he was from a commercial credit company, and said, I'd like to check the number on your cars. I says, sir, I've only got one car. He says, no, you've got two. You're making payments on two. I says, no, I'm not. He says, well, there's something awful wrong, because we've got you down that you've got motor number, your car, motor number, so-and-so, motor number, so-and-so, on another, and you're making payments on both of them. I says, sir, I just can't have two cars. I can't afford two cars. I couldn't afford to make those payments on two. And he checked the number on the car I had there, and it checked with one of them. And he said, you sure you don't have this other? And I said, no, sir, I don't have it any place. Well, he says, I'll go back to Oklahoma City and see how what's wrong, see if I can find what's wrong, and how we can be a credit to you with two cars and making payments on two of them. So, several days later, I got a letter from him, and he said, well, you were right. Said, some way, we got two sets of papers made and got the title number from the car you have on for the motor number on the other one. And when your check came in, it was credited to the both of them. And we don't know just how that happened. But anyway, we sure thank you for the way you have cooperated with us in getting this straightened out, and that your name will go down in the records as being very helpful, and that you can have anything that the commercial credit company, of the commercial credit company that you ever want, without any argument. So, a couple years later, I purchased a brand new car in Eanes, Oklahoma, and they carried the papers on that, and about 3 years later, I purchased, traded that car, that, and then on another new one, and they carried the papers on that. And later on, when I moved to the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, I bought a fellow came along wanted to sell me a new car, and so I said, what do you want to know? He says, you want a good used car? And I says, I got a good used one. Well, he says, how about a new one then? I said, well, I'll talk to you on that. And this car I had is the one I'd bought new in East Oklahoma. At that time, it was about 5 years old and been driven 105,000 miles. And he says, well, what do you want? I says, I want that car to stand for the down payment on a new one. So he argued and fumed a while, and I said, well, that's the only way I'll trade, is that being the down payment. So he says, well, we'll probably lose money on it, but we'll trade with you. Come on down to West Lacoa this evening. He says, you live in Edinburgh. I says, right. And he says, well, come on down to West Lacoa and we'll make the deal. He says, after you get off work, well, Dot and Donna and I went down there. Later on, and well, you'll hear about Donna later on. We went down to West Lacoa, and we picked out the car, and he said, now, what credit references you have? I don't have any in this area, only the commercial credit. I says, they have a place in Harlingen, don't they? Yes, they carry all the papers on these things. I says, well, I think I've got pretty good credit with them. Call them up. So he called the Harlingen office, commercial credit, and got down on the phone, told him who I was and what I wanted, and says, okay, I'll hold. So a little bit, my fella says, that's so? Well, okay. And he came back to me and he said, that guy says that your credit with commercial credit company is A1 and that anything that you want is to be given to you. And he says, what in the world did you do to establish such a place with them that they got you listed in every one of their offices? Because they usually don't do that. That you have to call another office. And I told him what had happened. He says, well, no wonder, because you really saved them a lot of trouble. So I got the car. That was the third new car I ever got, and the last one I ever bought on a time payment plan, as all the cars I've purchased since that time, I've been able to plank down the cash for them. The depression was really getting bad by this time, and everybody was really worried, and so they had a job, they tried to hang on to it, even if they had to take some cut and pay, which along right after the first of the year of 31, a lot of people got pay cuts. However, I made a suggestion for something that was needed. They told me to work it out. I worked it out, and Shell patented it and gave me a $5 a month raise in pay, which was a whole lot better than a cut that a lot of people were getting in pay at that time. Also, around this time, I starting to date this young lady I spoke about earlier very regularly, and we finally, in the middle of the 31. I got an engagement ring put on her finger, and we set the wedding date for the Sunday after Thanksgiving of 1931. And my folks came down to the area right after Thanksgiving, and we had the wedding at her house at high noon on the 29th day of November 1931, which was a highlight in my life. Sometime before the wedding, we had gone into Sears Roebuck. They were having a kitchen range and living room heater stove sale, and we bought a kitchen range and a heating stove. I think the two of them came to some $35.40, something like that. Wasn't very big. And old boy says, you want this on payment plan? I said, no, I'm going to plank down the cash for these. Well, he says, now your credit here at Sears Roebuck and Enid is top notch. I said, well, you don't know me. He says, yes, we do. We know that you and this young lady are getting married. You work for Shell at Marshall, Oklahoma, and she lives in Covington, and we know that you've got a wedding date set for the 29th day of November, and your credit is good. Well, I said, I'll pay the cash anyway. He says, now, you're going to want some other furniture before long. I said, yes. He said, well, I was thinking of coming down next week and seeing you two and finding out about all this. So that's the reason I'd made all these investigations of you. And I'm going to ask you to, when you want the rest of your furniture, to be sure and come back, because I'll take care of you. And so the Saturday before the wedding, we went into the county seat, Enid of Garfield County, where she lived, got the marriage license, went to Sears and picked out all of our furniture. We had a three-piece living room set, bedroom set with dresser, which we still have, actually, and a dinette set, and a kitchen utensils, set of dishes, everything ready. We could set up housekeeping. And I didn't have the cash to plank down for all that. That came $211, just a little over $211. And some of that stuff we're still using. Today happens to be the 22nd day of June, 1978. Now approaching Schulenburg on U.S. Highway 77, and soon turn on to Interstate 10 Highway at Schulenburg. We moved into a house in Marshall, Oklahoma that Sunday night after the wedding. Sears had got our furniture there, and we had everything there. And we moved in that night, and we set up housekeeping right then. No honeymoon, no vacation, or no nothing. All of the guests at the wedding were my parents and her parents, of course, and the brothers and sisters. I think one of her sisters wasn't there. And the fellow that I worked with at the plant that had become the fractionating column operator, and two of her girlfriends. That was the entire guest list. My parents had brought a bunch of food, a big turkey, and some of the other people had brought some stuff, and her folks had a bunch of stuff, and we had a big Thanksgiving dinner then, that wedding dinner after the wedding. And my brother was there too. I've come to think about it, he was there. And we had this big dinner, including the preacher and his wife and two children. Quite a dinner. And my brother thought he got off a cute one. He and one of my wife's girlfriends decided they were going to go out on the town or something that night. And the other girlfriend says, "Well, don't you want to take the rest of us?" He says, "Well, Homer is an old married man. No, he doesn't want to go." And everybody got a big laugh out of that. This house we moved into cost us $11 a month rent. We had to pay our own utilities, which weren't very much. I think gas cost us 25 cents a thousand cubic feet. And electricity was about 0.2 cents a kilowatt hour. And so the utilities weren't very much. We had a small radio that didn't use much juice, and so we were getting along pretty well. After about a couple months, my wife found a house that she liked better. We were paying $10 a month for that house, and she found a house that she liked a lot better. And we only pay $11 a month for it. So, in the same town, Marshall, Oklahoma. And about 3 months after we moved into that house, this fractionating column operator got moved to St. Louis, Missouri, in the head office in St. Louis, Missouri. And so they made me the column operator again, as well as the loading clerk or shipping clerk or shipping man anyway. And they raised my pay again, $5 a month. Also, this fellow had been moved into the St. Louis office. He'd been living in a company house at the plant, and they told me we could move into it. So we moved into that company house where no rent, and nothing for utilities. So we were a living good then, really living good. We even put money in the savings account. This latter move was in 1932, when we moved into the company house. Sometime along in August, latter part of August, I think it was, the wife said one day, she says, "I think you had better prepare to become a father." We went to the doctor and he confirmed it. She had quite a time of morning sickness with that one. Nothing unusual happened for the rest of the year, with the exception that I was working long hours, and we were doing a lot of new stuff on special products, because that was the only way we could make any money with this plant, was out of supplying special products to various people. On the night of February the 8th, our superintendent was sick of bed, chief engineer was sick of bed, and the operation of the plant was falling to me, a whole plant at that time then. Another fellow called in that he wasn't going to be able to make the make his shift at 12 o'clock at night. He was down with influenza, as all these other people were down with influenza. I went down to the bunkhouse and found a fellow there that could come and fill in the operating crew at midnight. And one fellow on that day, a tremendous blizzard had hit. The wind was blowing about 35 to 40 miles an hour, and it was snowing, and temperature dropped to 10 below zero. The next day, the superintendent and chief engineer felt well enough to come out to work. But while I was there at the bunkhouse that night, the one fellow that had been there at the plant all the time, he says, "Well," he says, "back on this date at 11 o'clock in the morning of 1928, he said, the plant blew up on a day just like this one has been." And somebody says, "Hush, hush, we don't want anything like that to happen in the night." The next day, I was having quite a time in keeping things thawed out in the fractionating plant, and as well as they were in the plant itself. However, approaching the evening, we'd put another man on shift with the operator to help him, and I was having to do it somewhat myself. I went in the house at a little before six and told wife I wanted to eat, and I had to get back out there and look after some stuff. Still 10 below zero, wind blowing, but it quit snowing somewhat by that time. So she says, "Well, sweep the snow off the front porch while I fry you a couple eggs. So I swept the snow off of the porch, and I heard the television going. I mean, not the television, it wasn't on then. The radio going, and I heard it say, a fellow says, it is now exactly at the sound of the tone, it will be exactly six. And that time, boom, and the plant blew up. Didn't know what it was that blown up, but determined later it was one stock tank right in the middle of our stock tank battery. And there were 16 of them, and eventually went up. Every one of them went up with a ball of fire 100 feet into the air. I immediately ran out the back door and went around the corner of the fence. The office was exactly opposite us over the fence in the plant yard. And I ran around there and counted for everybody but the operator and the extra man we'd put on. I didn't know just what had happened to them, and wasn't anything I could do about it. I couldn't get out there because the fire was too bad. I ran back to the house and told Dorothy. I don't think I ever mentioned what her name had been. It was Dorothy Millicent Mead. She changed it to Dorothy Givens. I run back to the house, and I told her to get out and get over to the Shank's store, which was a little store over about 400 yards over from the plant, and that I was going to see if there was anything else I could do before I got out of there. She grabbed up a quilt, went around and turned out all the fires, and grabbed up a quilt, threw what she thought was my new suit into it, and it turned out the one I'd never put on again. My billfold and her purse and some gloves, and she started out, she was in a big old heavy house coat and house shoes, but the quicker she got outside and she lost one of the house shoes in the snow, she went back in and got some other shoes on and went on over to the store. By the time she got there, everybody had left there to gone to the production camp, which was about a half a mile to the east along the road. So she went right across a lot at the back lot from this store, back of a cafe, and get back out on the road. A fellow picked her up in a pickup, hauled her over and let her out at this production camp. And she got with some other people there, and they then later on she turned up her gloves and my billfold and her purse turned up missing. A couple days later, she found somebody found the gloves up in the top of their kitchen cabinet. Her purse, a fellow finally brought it in out of the pickup, and my billfold was nowhere to be found. About a year and a half later, it was found by a bunch of kids riding a horse out back of this grocery store, and it was pretty well rotten. And however, the only way you could identify whose it was a picture of Zada had in it. There were three $1 bills that I did get a replacement on them by taking them into the bank. Now, the night I'd been down to the bunkhouse and talking about the plant when it blew up before, people telling how they run. There's one young fellow there, he says, don't do any good to run. If it's your time to be killed by a gasoline plant blowing up, why, you'll get it whether you're running or not. And he said, it just didn't happen to be any of you's time. And so you run for nothing. And later in the evening after we'd got back into the plant, got things kind of settled down, and got gas going to the places where we had been selling it and saw that it was still going there. We got steam back up to where we could keep things from freezing up solid and bursting. This young fella said that when they used to running at that time, he came to me and he said, will you help me? Well, he'd had a big foot locker like they had in the army, packed, and a suitcase packed, ready to go on his vacation. When it started snowing, he had to call it off for a while. I said, what do you need help for? He said, carry my stuff back. Well, he'd carried that about a quarter of a mile back up away from the bunkhouse. I thought you said that it wouldn't be any use of running. He says, you know, something like that happens, you can't tell your feet not to run. He says, I found out. And he says, and I took this stuff with me because I didn't want to lose it. We had to stop and rest twice carrying it back. He carried it without stopping. They found out later, this extra man we'd put on, he was in the boiler house when that explosion came, and the operator just started to go down to the tanks. And when it blew, this boiler fireman and this extra man took out east from the plant, away from the explosive part, and they were running along. Well, the boiler fireman lived across the creek from the plant. He circled back over there. And, this extra man we put on, he was huffing and a puffing. He said, Carl, Gil, you don't know what happened. Yeah, I guess he was right down on top of those tanks. And this fella, he was running behind him, says, don't you know me? He'd run and caught up with him. He hadn't got down to the tanks. The only casualty was one fella froze his ears. He's still suffering. His ears get a little cold weather. His ears still bother him from that time they were frozen, frostbitten. When the snow all melted, the old yard man raked the yard, camp yard. There was a bunkhouse, and one, two, three, four, five, six, six houses and a bunkhouse people lived in, and all together at that time there was 21 children lived there. The old fella, when he raked the yard up, he said there wasn't a square foot, that there wasn't some kind of a piece of iron on it. Within seconds after that first explosion, a yard was covered with children and people. Grown people are running and getting away from there, but not one of them got hit by anything. About 11 o'clock, we all gathered over to the production office, and we were sitting there, and I says, has anybody called Tulsa? And superintendent says, oh, my Lord, no. Says, well, you're sitting next to the phone, put in a call and get a hold of Fred Schrock. He was our assistant general superintendent. And so I put in the call. The phone rang and rang and rang and rang and rang, and I began to think he wasn't going to answer it. Well, I kept letting it ring, and finally he said, oh, Mr. Schrock, plant blew up. This Homer, I said, the plant blew up. Nobody's hurt. Okay. Hung up. So I hung up. Johnson says, well, what did he say? And he said, well, okay. And hung up. He said, well, wait a little bit. He'll call back in a few minutes. A little bit, the phone rang. I answered it. He said, what did you say? I said, the plant blew up and nobody was hurt. Well, what blew up? I said, all the stock tanks. Oh, he said, my God, oh, my God. And he said, well, I'll try to get out there tomorrow. I said, I don't think you can make it. They haven't got the roads cleared enough yet. Well, he said, I'll get there the next day then. Which he did, barely. About midnight, the chief engineer another fellow, operator, and myself was in the plant office when the farmer lived a mile and a half away from the plant or so, came in carrying a baby. He said, whose baby is this? And the chief engineer looked, said, well, that's mine. And they had a little girl with him. He says, that's mine there, too. Says, so he says, where'd you pick them up? He says, well, somebody left them at our house and beat it on someplace else. He says, that's all I know. He says, Steve right here, he says, you don't know where my wife is? He says, no. And she wasn't the one that left them. I think it was your oldest daughter that left them. And I don't know where she went. We had many a laugh over things that happened that night when it turned out that nobody was hurt. And all that happened was tanks blew up. Of course, our fractionating unit was ruined. And our loading facilities were all ruined. We had no tanks to put gasoline in. However, there wasn't anything there to keep us from starting to make gasoline again. So we started making gasoline and put it right straight into a pipeline, oil pipeline, until they got the tankage in again and we could start making the special products. Actually, it was around 30 hours after the fire when we started making the gasoline again direct into the pipeline, and we got two tanks in and started making gasoline into them in 44 hours. We'd make into one and figure our production that way and then pump it direct into the pipeline. However, we weren't getting the money that we should get for that gasoline as we would have if we'd been making special products. However, we had to get one new column for our fractionating setup, and we had to get a bunch of controls. So it was about 6 weeks before we got the new column and got it set up. And by that time, we'd had everything practically ready. The controls were in and most of them installed. It was the first natural gas processing plant that had a control board instead of local mounted controls on everything as previous. This, we had one big board and all the controls were on that board with the exception of level controls. These were all new controls that the company had just brought out, and they were the kind that had automatic reset and some proportional band, or what we at that time called the throttling range. So we started up. One of them wouldn't work on throttling range any amount, and to get a straight line, we had to put it at working pressure rise very, very fast, and the valve opened and closed somewhat every second. On another column that we made two different special products on, one of them we would have to run at one proportional band setting and one reset setting. On the other product, we had to have a much longer proportional band or throttling range setting, and to do that, they had to change, go inside and change a bracket that took quite a little bit to work, probably 30 minutes of work to do that changing. And so I went to work and dug out of fire hazard, high fire stuff, some old controls that weren't damaged very much, and put me in a rack and pinion on that throttling range deal where I could change the throttling range by just turning a knob from one place to another and not have to spend all that time changing the brackets. Later in the summer then, when we got to running good, the chief engineer of the company, the control manufacturing company, came by and he checked that, looked at it, and he worked on it. And he, as we weren't actually making any special product on that column at that particular time, and as we had our tankage all full of it, and he could play with it and check it out, see just how the thing worked, and he says, "It sure does work good, doesn't it?" He said, "What do you call that?" I says, "That is my full scope controller. My full scope controller," I told him. He says, "That sounds like a pretty fair name." He said, "I'll remember that." And left, and I never heard any more about it until the next year at the oil show. Just before the oil show, my boss called me up out of the Tulsa office and says, "You're to be at the opening ceremonies of the International Oil Exposition here in Tulsa in a couple of weeks. He says, make your plans to be here." I said, "Yes, sir." And so I made my plans and I got there, and they had the opening ceremonies, and which they always went through, raising the big flag, and the extolling the virtues of the oil business, and then they opened the gates and went in and went